Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. If you can hold it down back there, please. Good evening and welcome to the Tuesday, March 24th Carrboro Board of Aldermen public hearing. Before we begin printed agenda, I have two quick things. One is, first of all, I'd like to acknowledge a great development that has occurred here at Carrboro Town Hall, which is that our town clerk is back with us at our aldermen meetings. Welcome back.
Yeah. Thank you. Good to be back.
It's good to see you, Sarah.
Thanks.
And second of all, I just briefly was asked to mention, for anybody who is interested in improving their public speaking skills, the organization Toastmasters is meeting over on the UNC campus. They meet at the Health Sciences Library on Tuesdays at 11:45 in the morning and on Wednesdays at 5:30 in the evening. And if you would be interested in learning how to improve your public speaking skills, you would be perfectly welcome to join the Toastmasters organization 11:45 on Tuesdays or 5:30 p.m. on Wednesdays in the fifth floor conference room at the Health Sciences Library at UNC. Okay. Now, the first item on our agenda is a public hearing on the final draft of the Comprehensive Bicycle Transportation Plan. Mr. Manager.
Okay. We do have a public hearing, and this is on the draft of the Comprehensive Bike Plan prepared by Greenways Incorporated, and Adina Messinger, our transportation planner, will introduce the consultant who's going to do the presentation. Adina.
Good evening. Before I introduce Matt, who's going to do the presentation, I wanted to draw your attention to the letter that was placed at your seats. It's a letter from NCDOT, and it's just stating that they have approved the plan, which is one of the final steps in the grant process and in this planning process. And as the letter notes, if you all have changes that you want to see made to the plan, we'll forward those to DOT for their review again, and they'll take a look at that. The other thing I wanted to just have a quick opportunity to say, and I know you all heard me say this in October, but I did just want to thank the Bicycle Plan Steering Committee and the many citizens who participated in this planning process. So I really appreciate that, and of course appreciate the hard work of the consultants during the past year that we've worked on this project. Without any further comment from me, I will introduce Matt Hayes from Greenways Incorporated, who's going to take you through the contents of the plan.
Thanks, Adina. Thanks, everyone, for having us out tonight. I just want to thank the town for the opportunity to work here. Personally, it was a great pleasure to work on this plan. Came here in 2000 for my master's degree at Carolina and spent a lot of time in Chapel Hill and Carrboro, still do, so it's really nice to be able to work on a bicycle plan right in the area that I'm familiar with. It was certainly an advantage to kind of know the lay of the land already, and it was real exciting to work on this project. As Adina has mentioned before, the funding for this project came from the NCDOT Bicycle and Pedestrian Planning Grant Program, which has been in existence since 2004. A handful of communities have received these awards, Carrboro being one, of course, now. It's a program that's really stimulating interest across the state in bicycle and pedestrian planning. Just the idea that you could choose to walk or bike instead of getting in your car is a message that's getting around the state pretty well with this program. So it's great that Carrboro applied and received this grant. And she mentioned the advisory committee. I'd have to give further kudos. We do bicycle and pedestrian planning around the state. This is by far the best committee we've worked with, I would say. Very active, took a lot of care in their commitment, and really put their heart and soul into it. A lot of time spent to look at the work that we have done and to make it better, to chisel it, and to improve it. And, of course, Adina as well has spent so many countless hours helping us craft this plan and really fine-tuning it. So all those people really should be commended, along with the citizens who I know I see some tonight who have been very active throughout this process, coming out to public meetings and really speaking with us and about their interest in the plan. A little bit of the project history. Planning began January 2008. During that time, we've had two public workshops and an online survey to get some response from the public, monthly steering committee meetings. I believe the presentation of the first draft was in October that you all heard. Brian Bergler was representing Greenways Incorporated at the time. He was a former staff. He moved out to Denver. He's another person I wanted to give props to because he's certainly an avid cyclist and biked around Carrboro for many, many years and really had a lot of a big role in determining facility recommendations here in Carrboro. The final draft was completed in January 2009, referred to advisory boards for recommendation in February, and this is a public hearing for adoption of the plan tonight. One of the things we wanted to establish early on was the project vision. This is a guiding vision statement that we use throughout the entire planning process. Very comprehensive. Carrboro will be a place that is bicycle-friendly, where people have an accessible, safe, and convenient option of bicycling for transportation, recreation, and health, where bicycle lanes and greenways provide a connected system within and outside the town, where future development provides access and facilities for bicyclists, where bicycle transportation is the easy choice, and where proposed policies and programs educate, inspire, and encourage residents and enforce safe bicyclist and motorist behavior. Very comprehensive vision. I think that covered quite a bit in one statement. And breaking that down further, we established goals early on in the process with the committee. These are four of the main goals. We have a series of sub-goals and objectives that were measurable throughout the process and into the implementation of the plan. The goals are to have bicycling as a viable transportation alternative throughout the town for all trip purposes. The second goal is a continuing process for reviewing, updating, and implementing bicycle-related policies. The goal of the plan was to really have a robust, comprehensive look at a program that incorporates engineering, education, encouragement, enforcement, and evaluation programs, and finally, a safe and accessible network of bicycle facilities. Public involvement was a big piece of this whole effort, something we really strive to get a good cross-section of the folks here in Carrboro. We had two public workshops where we laid out maps to get feedback from the public about where they'd like to see bicycle lanes, bicycle paths, where they were concerned about dangerous areas in the town. We also wanted to hear from them about their goals. They helped craft the goals and vision as well. We took that statement to the public, and they provided their input as well. We had an online comment form, which we also had hard copy surveys as well that we distributed. We had 396 responses from that, which was very good. I know there was another, in addition to a workshop, I think the committee members went out to Weaver Street one night and received some input that way as well. So there are a number of different methods that we used. The draft plan review was another big role the public had. This plan was available in the fall for folks to take a look at and give us feedback on. So that was another level of public involvement. We had a series of newsletters and flyers, quick snapshots of the project as we were going along to keep the public informed of what was going on and how they could provide input into the process. This looks maybe to you all like a very boring selection, but to kind of to conclude the public involvement piece, I just wanted to show this. How do you rate present bicycling conditions in the Carrboro area? This is one of the questions that we had in our comment form. We asked similar questions to this, whether it be a bicycle or pedestrian plan across the state, to all the communities that we work in. And Carrboro would be the first time we've ever heard fair. And what does that mean? We normally hear poor. I think 75% of the people in Carrboro said it was fair. Indicating to us that Carrboro is certainly a lot further advanced perception than other communities. And it's not just perception, it's reality. Carrboro has been at this since 1980 when the first bicycle lane was put in. So I thought this was very kind of interesting and telling that while we have certainly come a long way, fair still indicates some room for improvement. And we certainly heard from the public about what some of those improvements should be. Getting into a discussion of what the plan looks like, we developed a structure of these five E's that you see here. These 5Es are used by the League of American Bicyclists when they determine bicycle-friendly communities. And of course, Carrboro is one of the few communities in the state that have already achieved a bronze-level bicycle-friendly community. We decided to use the same structure in the development of this plan as well. Taking a look at engineering, one of the main things that we were tasked with doing is looking at a bicycle network. This map that you see here and probably can't read very well is that network of recommendations for the town. We were looking at connecting existing facilities. Certainly there are a number of gaps that are still out there that don't quite complete bicycle trips, so we made recommendations to fill those gaps, connecting destinations with bicycle lanes, sharrows, and shared use paths. And certainly the public had a major role in this process and input into their goals of the facilities. We took it a step further and prioritized the network as well. That was through a process that took place in the committee meetings, where we looked at a number of criteria for segments of the bicycle network that we recommended, including whether it connected to a school, whether it connected to the downtown. We had about 15 different criteria, along with whether or not it was a top public requested facility, came up with our priority routes. This is an example of a cut sheet of one of those priority routes that we supplied in the draft plan. This is really, we think, is a really usable tool for the town, very step-by-step, action-oriented, that tells you what the facility recommendation is along a certain corridor. So these cut sheets will be very action-oriented and usable for the town. Beyond the recommendations for physical facilities in the field, whether it be a bicycle lane or a path, that sort of thing, we looked at programming. One of the things that we recommend pursuing after this is the bicycle advocacy group that can really champion the implementation of this plan. Bicycle-friendly communities around the country, all of them have bicycle advocacy groups really promoting this on a daily basis, being involved in different programming elements, so that's one of our recommendations. The TAB, the Greenways Commission, these are other groups that can be involved in programming. The three E's are what we typically look at: education, encouragement, and enforcement. So we have a number of recommendations throughout the plan that look at not only education to the general public, but also internal education to get people up to speed, whether it be engineers, public works, planners, to understand bicycle facilities, bicycle planning, what this plan means. Encouragement programs as well, and enforcement programs, and we've listed probably dozens of these for the town to consider. This is one example of a section from our programming section of the plan. We did a number of case studies throughout. This is a section from encouragement, and we looked at the city of Portland and what they've done in terms of some employer incentive programs. So we have case studies inserted throughout the plan that were selectively chosen that should help guide the town when implementing some of these programs. Policies were another key component to all of this, getting the right policies in place so that as development occurs in the future, bicycle transportation is given a fair shake. The 1989 bicycle and pedestrian policy document is a real solid document that's been in existence for quite a while. We inserted a number of different additional policies that strengthen that. The addition of new facility types to consider and the importance of programming are a couple of examples. We had specific recommendations for updates to the land use ordinance as well. Parking was a big element. Bicycle parking was a big element of that. And also recommendations for update to the Vision 2020. Really, we go in there and just take a look at where we can insert some more bicycle language that would promote the consideration of bicycle facilities and programming in the future. Another section of the plan is design guidelines, taking a look at the most modern national guidelines and inserting them into the plan for Carrboro to take a look at goals to reach. So it's a comprehensive suite of treatments of all the different recommendations that we had. Probably one of the biggest elements, and it's kind of really unique to the town of Carrboro, are the five E's that I've described before, kind of the centerpiece of the plan. We developed a series of tables. These are actually based on the League of American Bicyclists application for a bicycle-friendly community. The audit variables are over here on the left, and we took a look at what Carrboro has already achieved on some of those and what it can still achieve. We added a number of new elements that are not in the bicycle-friendly community application, so we think this is a real strong piece that, and really action-oriented, that the town can use in the future for those five E's. We have a series of appendices as well. Prioritization, how do we get to determine what those priority routes were? certainly public input, all the results, all the comments we heard from the public, funding, look at federal and state policies. Some of those policies are just not as well known that on the federal and state level that are really to support bicycle transportation, so we inserted those. Had a section on the value of bicycling for transportation, covered what has been existing planning efforts, and also a glossary of terms. In terms of where we are now, we've received a number of comments throughout the whole process. We've received them from NCDOT Bike Ped Division as part of their review of the plan and have made those changes. Of course, the steering committee has continually provided us feedback, so we've made those revisions as well. Town of Carrboro staff, Adina and others, have certainly put a lot of effort into giving us feedback. The public, certainly you all, we've taken a look at your comments that you provided from the, I guess, the October session. Integrated all these comments into the final draft. It's been a collaborative process. We've been working closely with Adina on getting all these comments taken care of. And really one thing to emphasize, too, with this plan is that it really is a living, breathing document and that it needs to be continually updated over time. And I think that's something that the town will have to continue to do as things change in the future. So that is the quick summary of where we've been and how we've gotten to where we are. We have really certainly appreciated the opportunity to work here and feel like we've gotten a lot of great feedback and support for the plan, and open it up for any questions that you all might have.
Yes. Could you speak to the, I don't have the exact term, I don't think, the bicycle advocacy organization that's recommended and kind of how the committee and yourself see its role in terms of furthering the implementation of the plan over time?
I think that's certainly, I don't know if you have some comments on that, Adina. I know that's something that we've been kind of back and forth on, and I think that current advisory committee members who are part of this process, this plan process, are certainly interested in continuing in a role of that nature. We've heard from a number of different citizens at public meetings who would like to be involved with that kind of role. It could be certainly a town-appointed group, or it could be a group that kind of volunteers on their own. I think the biggest thing that they can do is just be a champion of the plan. I think and working in different the programming elements is probably a major role, whether it be educational programs or encouragement programs, and really being active in the community to encourage people to get out and bicycle. So I think that that's probably the major role that they can have is to really see this bicycle plan, all the work that's gone in, that things are being implemented, that things are happening.
And my recollection from the document, though, is that it calls for an independent organization. Is that right, or is it kind of, are you saying it could go either way? Or
I believe it. You may have the better answer to that, because we've been back and forth on that a little bit.
I think actually that's correct. We're thinking about an independent group that would not be a town-appointed committee, because that would really enable them to take a strong advocacy role. If it grows to the point where it could be a nonprofit, then they might have some grant opportunities that the town would not have as a local government. And so we just thought that it would we do have a transportation advisory board already, and they do great work on bicycle issues. This would be something a little bit different, and thought that it might be more of an interest to folks to be part of a more of an advocacy group.
So. Okay. So the idea is that people who want to be engaged in furthering the bicycle friendliness or that vision, really.
Exactly. And I think, one of the roles could be to kind of just keep an eye on the town, really, and check in and say, where are you with this, and how do we, how can we help you, get to this next point?
Great. Thank you.
We have a couple of people signed up to speak. Maybe it'd be good to go ahead and hear from those folks, and it may inspire some questions from us.
Sure.
For you. So the first person signed up is Wayne Pine.
Short people. Mr. Mayor, Alderman, I was a bicycling researcher at UNC for 7 years. In 1996, I subcontracted greenways for over for a report that I wrote on integrating trails with roads. I've been riding here daily for nearly 22 years. I sent you all a link about Carlboro's bike lanes that I hope you can read. It shows how most of Carlboro's bike lanes are unwarranted and substandard. I'm speaking against this plan. Carlboro is strongly pursuing and has strongly pursued a paradigm of separation in which bicyclist space is reduced and motoring is facilitated unwittingly. Bicyclists are erroneously considered a third category separate from motorists or pedestrians. I offer a simpler, better, and less costly alternative. Remove all bike lanes and place signs or pavement markings affirming bicyclists' right to use as much of the roads as we see fit, which is consistent with state law. Rather than a paradigm of divisive separation, pursue a paradigm of integration and cooperation. The proposed plan has numerous mischaracterizations and much fear-mongering. Perceived lack of safety is conflated with an alleged lack of actual safety. Roads that don't have bike lanes are mischaracterized as dangerous and roads with bike lanes as safe and bicycle-friendly. Bike lanes are more accurately described as motorist-friendly and unfriendly to bicyclists. Here's how. I have a little prop here. For design purposes, bicycles are considered this wide. If I ride my bike down any road, even with a narrow lane, say Fayetteville, Estes Drive, or anywhere, I basically have an entire lane in front of me of smooth pavement. It's like my own bike lane. So to put down a stripe and say that this much space, or even this much space, the minimum amount, is friendly to me, is just insulting. If I ride in a wide lane, such as Rosemary Street, motorists can pass easily, and I'm okay with that. But if you put down a stripe there, and then you're confining me to an inevitably debris-filled spot, that's not being friendly to me. That's friendly to motorists. Bicyclists are drivers of vehicles, like pizza-powered motorcyclists, not some third category separate from motorists and pedestrians. In the NCDOT driver's manual, it reminds everyone that bicyclists are entitled to use of the full lane. Nowhere in this plan does it recognize these crucial points. Wherever bicycle facilities exist, restrictions are put on bicyclists. Bike lanes themselves are restrictions enforced by motorists. Carlboro's written statutes, surprisingly, are restrictions. You have statutes written that are more restrictive than the state of North Carolina. North Carolina is one of eight states that has no limits on bicycling. And yet, in so-called bicycle-friendly Chapel Hill and Carlboro, you have these restrictions that are on the books. Helmet laws, mandatory helmet laws, are restrictions. If you love something, let it be free. By asking for bike lanes, bicyclists are like frogs in the pot of slowly boiling water. Worse, they've jumped in the pot. Argue for your limitations, and sure enough, they're yours. All the bike lanes in Carlboro are previously wide lanes. So when the bike lane stripe has gone down, you've actually restricted bicyclist space and created a guaranteed debris area. Thank you.
Next speaker is Elise Giddings.
Hello, I'm Elise Giddings, owner of Cycle 9, local bike shop here in Carlboro. I just wanted to comment on the plan, and let me first comment on the last speaker because I had some reaction to that, and actually agree in some respects to some of what he's saying. I've also bicycle commuted for, 20-some years. And I personally feel very confident riding in a lane of traffic with no bicycle lane, but I don't want my five-year-old doing that. So I think in some ways he's right in terms of people who are confident and who want to ride. That's great, but other people do not have that confidence, and they need separated and different facilities. I mean, there's different people, different ways of riding. I guess I just wanted to say my reaction to the plan was I thought it was, I was very impressed with the amount of public input that was requested for the plan, and I myself had several opportunities to comment, and I thought that was really good. And I really like the way they have gone beyond just engineering aspects into education and encouragement. And I think the more we can encourage and educate people about riding their bikes really gives people kind of a flexible alternative for transportation that goes beyond anything that we need. It's a local opportunity where we don't need anything from other people to have that transportation alternative. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I know there are a lot of cyclists here, and I only have two people who were signed up to speak. Let me ask if you're here to kind of echo what Elise Giddings just said and want to support her and agree with what she just said, you know, give us a little wave right now to show some support for what she has to say. Thank you. And I think if you have some different points that you'd like to make, we would invite you to come and come up to the podium. So if you would raise your hand. Yes, sir, way in the back. Come on up.
So, like most people in Carborough,
I need you to come up to the mic so the folks watching at home can hear you.
So I have a question
and
for
Ms. Say your name, please.
Oh, Tom Roach. I have a question for Ms. Messenger and the gentleman from Greenways. Like most people in Carborough, I spend a lot of time going to Chapel Hill. I'd like for you to discuss what efforts you're making to connect with Chapel Hill, specifically Estes Road east of Greensboro. Myself, I'm one of the people who tends to take the lane. I don't have a particular problem with that intersection, although, of course, I would like to be the part just east of Greensboro to be just as nice as the parts farther down. But we have a 12-year-old who goes to Smith. It's a problem for her. So I'd like to find out more about how you're working with Chapel Hill and specifically what will be done about Estes just east of Greensboro.
We'll have her come up and address those points in a few minutes. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and hear from other folks first. And then, yes, ma'am, right here.
Hi, my name is Carol Barrow, and I live in Heritage Hills down Smith Level Road. I like that highway so much that I adopted Smith Level Road. I can't ride my bicycle into town because there isn't any shoulder on that road from the county line to, well, maybe now to the new high school, but when there's no shoulder at all, my 14-year-old and my 12-year-old can't ride it, and there is no other way for them to get into town without somebody driving them. I would like to not just advocate independence, but it's a lot of driving going back and forth, when a kid could be burning some energy and some calories and keeping the air clean and learning independence and getting to school by themselves and all kinds of other things. And I like that road. It's a beautiful road. Coming to my house every day from Carborough, it's a beautiful road. I've got a farm there. I got horses there, all kinds of beautiful things, and can't walk it. Can't ride it, can't push a baby carriage, can't, you could fall in a ditch if you're really happy, and then after that you could clean up the road or other people drop their stuff. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'd like a multi-purpose lane, please.
All right. Yes, sir, right there. Thanks, Carol.
Thanks.
My name is Robert McConville, and I'm a resident of Carborough, and I wanted to thank all the cyclists and the mayor and the town council for addressing this issue. I certainly do believe, like many people who have spoken today, that the road should be an inclusive place, and we shouldn't develop an identity by developing a negative identity with a line of delineation. Although I recognize that for some people, it is certainly important. For younger children, people who don't have the handling or developmental capacity to ride on the roads, it's a wonderful advantage. I myself coached the Special Olympic cycling team. in Orange County for 2.5 years, or 3 years, ultimately, and see great benefit for bikeways. However, my concern is when you create a lane, like many people have discussed here, that is adequate enough for an individual with very technical bike skills to maneuver through when you have road spillover. Gravel, on my way over here, actually, I rode Estes just to get myself familiar with what I was going to talk about. Rode Estes and Smith Level Road. I commuted on Smith Level this morning. And it's a harrowing experience. And my large concern is that traveling down the road at 35 miles an hour, if you were to confine a cyclist into a lane rather than a shared roadway on the downhill, you would actually create an issue where somebody was going to have to react to save their life. And they would react. Ultimately, there's one way to go, either into the sidewalk or into a car lane, if there's spillover into a bike lane. And if you don't create that shared inclusive attitude with education and also share ways on downhills, and I would hope the Greenway people would correct me if I'm wrong. From my understanding in the plan, Smith Level was a bike lane on the way down, and that scares me in any part of a plan where a cyclist could exceed 35 miles an hour just by taking their hands off the brakes. I think it's very important for the safety of everyone to consider that in the Greenway Greenway plan. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have we're going to be having a public discussion of the Smith Level Road plan at our April 21st meeting. that issue that you just brought up about the whether to have a bike lane on the steep downhill is something that the board has already asked the staff to speak to DOT about, whether that's really the best arrangement or whether we should just go with a wide outside lane on the downhill there. So, but just so you know that we're looking at that. was there anybody else who wanted to speak? Okay, if not, either the staff or the consultant come up and maybe address Mr. Roach's questions about the connections to Chapel Hill and specifically on Estes Drive.
Sure. Thanks for that question. We did have somebody from the town of Chapel Hill on the steering committee as one of the ways that we were seeking to engage the folks in Chapel Hill on commenting on the plan and making sure that what we've been putting down will coincide with what they have on the ground and with what they're planning. We've shared the plan with their bicycle transportation group, and I know that they have recently contacted us to make sure that they have the most recent copy of our plan, so that when they go ahead and are looking at their plan, they can make sure that what they're doing is going to coincide with what we've put down as well. So there is definitely an interest in constantly working with them and trying to make sure that what we're working towards is the same thing. Specifically with regards to Estes Drive, the part that I think you're referring to where the wide shoulders just kind of end, the town definitely is working on that in a couple of different ways. There are some right-of-way issues that have prevented those wide shoulders from extending all the way to Greensboro Street. And one of the things we're looking at is trying to put in a multi-use path on the, I guess it's the north side, that would connect about where the lanes end, that lane ends, and over to Wilson Park. And it's a little bit of a roundabout way, depending which direction you're going, but it would get you onto North Greensboro Street, where there are bike lanes. And we are still continuing to work with DOT on a transportation improvement program project that would put bike lanes the full extent of Estes Drive. And I think the town also has some projects that we're working towards making that a more bicycle and pedestrian-friendly corridor.
When Adina, when you said that there are right-of-way issues along the section where there is no wide shoulder right now, in other words,
we don't own that right-of-way.
We don't own much more land than where you see the pavement.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct.
That's
fine.
So
yeah.
We don't. It becomes a problem of you got to be taking parts of people's yards and that sort of thing. And it may eventually come to that, but it's much bigger, you know, financially it's a much bigger commitment than simply paving some land that the public already owned, which is what we've done so far.
Correct.
The other thing, if I may, just sticking on the connectivity to Chapel Hill point, that I would like to bring up is we are working on the Morgan Creek Greenway, and Chapel Hill is in the process. They're two steps further ahead of us in the development of their Morgan Creek Greenway, but they're you correct me if I'm wrong, but the upshot of it will be that there will be a greenway that will begin somewhere in Carrboro along Morgan Creek and run down to where the Smith Level Road bridge is. It'll pass underneath Smith Level Road and connect to Chapel Hill's greenway, which, as they're presently bidding out, I think, the work, and it'll go, where does that go? It goes to 15501 or something.
Yeah, I'm not sure the exact extent of this. That the part of their plan that would connect under the bridge is not being bid out right now. That's not part of the what's being bid out right now. It's the next phase. But absolutely, with both the Morgan Creek and Bowling Creek Greenway projects that we're working on, we're working with Chapel Hill to make sure that both of those connect with the greenways that Chapel Hill has.
Right.
Adina, am I remembering correctly that the current transportation improvement program now has a single project on Eubanks and Homestead at both the Chapel Hill and Carrboro portions?
Yes.
So that those are coordinated.
Right. So for many of the corridors that cross jurisdictional boundaries, not the actual state transportation improvement program, but the projects that the different municipalities that participate in the Durham-Chapel Hill-Carrboro Municipal Metropolitan Planning Organization, those projects that have been submitted for consideration in the TIP have been submitted with unified descriptions by the different jurisdictions. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I was actually going to elaborate on that point as well, that jurisdictional question, not only Eubanks Road, but Homestead Road and Sewell School Road, all three of those roads involve two or three jurisdictions in terms of coordination of you know, bike lanes and road improvement.
Adina, before you sit down, was someone circulating a sign-up sheet for people interested in the bicycle advocacy group?
Yes, I believe I saw that. So if you are interested in that, please make sure that you put your name on that list.
And is that just going around to the audience?
Yeah, it's sitting right there in the front row, so it can get passed around. Thanks.
Sign Carol up. All right. Yes.
I really want to thank the our staff, the consultants, the citizens who volunteered and participated in this, your leadership, Adina, and also our former transportation planner, Del McKeel, who started a lot of these ideas and helped improve pedestrian walkability and bicycle access to Carrboro residents. This is an outstanding plan, and looking forward to following your work and seeing the involvement of more citizens in Carrboro in enhancing these opportunities. Thank you.
Thanks.
Great job.
Okay. Is there a resolution in here?
I move to adopt the
Attachment A.
Attachment A.
All right. It's been moved.
Second.
And seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Thanks to everybody who came out tonight to be a part of this and who came out in the past to help us draft this plan. Let's all stick together and actually make it more than just a plan, but a reality on the ground.
I have a question for Steve before
yes.
we move on. Steve, independent of, I mean, a lot of what's in this plan are particular projects that are underway in other tracks, and I guess we're also going to hopefully have the Bicycle Advocacy Group bringing things to our attention. Are you anticipating any staff follow-up from time to time that would, say, provide us with a progress report on this plan or give us suggestions for, you know, initiatives to move it forward, or is that something that's not really specified yet?
Well, the planning staff and I haven't really talked about that in advance of the adoption, but I would assume that we would do something like that. I mean, our hope is it wouldn't just be a plan. It really would be something that we would all work towards trying to implement, and that would obviously involve staff as well as the community and the board. So,
okay. So at some point we might hear back from you on ideas for
I would anticipate that.
Great. Thanks.
All right. With that, we'll turn to agenda item A2, a draft ordinance to revise water quality buffer provisions in the Carborough Land Use Ordinance. If you were here just for the first item, yeah, it's interesting stuff, huh? If y'all were here just for the first item, if you would please exit rapidly so we can proceed with our meeting. Thanks.
We're going to invite them to stay.
No, I'm afraid they'll all speak on the water quality buffers. Well, if that doesn't show you what kind of community you live in, see that crowd out for the bicycle plan.
Isn't it amazing?
Really?
All right.
Got to connect another road. It'll fill up.
It's a cycling town.
Yes. Happily tuning up.
All right.
Yes.
Mr. Manager, item A2.
This is a public hearing on the land use ordinance text amendment relating to water quality buffers. As you all know, we've been working for a long time on the comprehensive revisions of our stream buffer provisions. We have Randy Dodd, our environmental planner, to give a presentation to the board prior to the public hearing. And we thought all those folks were here for stream buffers. Go figure.
The crowd's so large.
And that, yeah, it's kind of refreshing to have a large crowd in favor of something.
We'd ask all those people who want to speak on this issue be limited to 3 minutes.
I'm in Kevlar, we get that.
Good evening. Thanks for letting us bring this back to you to continue this public hearing. Just wanted to kind of give some history so we're all remembering how we got here. We've been talking about buffers in Carborough since 1983 at least. Lots of work over the decades. More recently, in the past 5 years or so, staff have been continuing to look more closely to look at this whole history of our consideration of buffers to see if there's ways we could improve upon what has been done. In 2008, staff undertook a pretty intensive process to look at the buffer ordinance provisions we have. This involved very frequent meetings of staff and, you know, a comprehensive review included folks, not just myself, but a variety of other people in the planning department, town engineer, town attorney. And that all culminated with a work session for you all back in October in anticipation of the possibility of this public hearing. After the work session, we met with a variety of advisory boards, and I have a slide here to show you exactly who has seen this, and then opened a public hearing in November, the end of November, and now we're continuing it. Why are we doing this? Our primary motivation as staff in bringing this to you is we believe there's an opportunity to really focus on water quality protection, and that is the overriding and absolutely front and center piece of this, is what it's been the forefront of our thinking. So what does that mean? It means a variety of things, and some of the important ones, minimizing erosion and sedimentation and the conveyance of runoff. And I want to distinguish here between sedimentation and erosion on construction sites or active development projects and during the conveyance. And when we're looking at buffers, we're talking about that part of the landscape that's transitional between the uplands or the developing areas and the surface waters. Simultaneously, we're also interested in nutrients. This is
driven by the fact that we're in the Jordan Lake watershed. And so there's existing requirements for nutrients, and there's also potential for additional future requirements. Erosion and sediment control does some of that for us, but it requires efforts above and beyond erosion and sediment control. Part of what we can have happen in buffers, and we want to encourage, and this is an important theme, is we're looking not just at sediment and pollutants in water, but we're looking at the ability of water to infiltrate into the ground, which is what buffers are ideally designed to do, thereby helping water quality and also helping recharge our groundwater table, which has a number of environmental benefits, including helping our streams make it through drought situations. And this isn't necessarily an environmental point, but it is something as staff that we feel very strongly that we have an opportunity here to, in essence, we believe that by adding specificity, we can have clarity, we can minimize ambiguity, this can benefit all people involved and affected by our stream buffer provisions. And in doing so, it reduces the risk of some kind of compromise to our buffer integrity because we're all clear about what we're trying to do. Buffers are one component of watershed protection. Here is showing, this is a slide from the Center for Watershed Protection, showing them as one of eight pieces. So I want to just get the point across that this isn't a panacea what we're bringing here. We have other work we have to continue to look at. So in addition to that primary motivation of surface water protection, these are sort of details and secondary motivations. There's a lot of work that's been happening with buffers in the past 10 or 20 years, and we want to make sure we're getting the latest, greatest from all the people who are thinking about it. We've had an opportunity to incorporate better data and address some of the technical challenges in our rules. We're continually monitoring the Jordan Lake rules, and so this is an opportunity to anticipate those rules. And as I'll show here in a minute, we have three different areas in town that we've had separate buffer regulations for in the past, and the lack of consistency across those areas has had some challenges for us in implementing the provisions. So where are those parts of town? We're looking at the whole planning jurisdiction here, and here's the University Lake watershed, and the remainder of town and outside of the northern transition area, shown in two pieces here. This is actually around Lake Hogan Farms area, and then finally the northern transition area. I don't want to delve into the details of this slide, but I just wanted to make the point about how each one of these areas of town have been handled differently in a variety of ways. It starts with our basic definition of what it is we're trying to buffer. Our streams, water bodies have been defined differently in these different areas. And then some other provisions, and just for example, our buffer widths are different in these different areas, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. And as well, how our buffer ordinance provisions deal with what is and isn't allowable varies across these different areas of town. So what we're proposing to do is now, instead of three areas, to drill down to just two areas. And the basic rationale here is that University Lake is a watershed, is a special water body and warrants special protection. But the difference in delineation between the northern transition area and the rest of town, in terms of these regulations in particular, is we're not recommending that we continue to maintain the distinctions.
Randy, not to get too far ahead of you here, but in the proposed changes, are there effectively changes for the University Lake watershed, or is the change really just for the area outside the University Lake watershed?
There are changes for the entire part of our jurisdiction.
All of it. Okay.
The changes are more significant for I would suggest for the area outside of the watershed, okay. but they are comprehensive. So in our proposed way of looking at this, instead of the variable ways we're looking at and defining streams, we now have one consistent definition, which is much more accepted in the profession. And we're basically defining perennial streams, intermittent streams, and ephemeral streams. Perennials are those that flow generally year-round, except perhaps in extreme droughts. Intermittent streams are streams that flow seasonally in response to seasonal changes in weather and climate. And ephemeral streams are those streams that just flow in response to a rain event. These are the smallest streams. They're headwater streams, and they may only carry water for a few hours or maybe a day or so after a rain event. So we've gotten consistency, and we've spent an awful lot of time in our GIS data and significantly upgrading our stream data. And then with buffer widths, we've developed some consistency here across these. We do recognize some additional protection in the University Lake watershed by having wider buffers, and also, as I'll mention in a moment here, we're distinguishing within the buffer in these proposed ordinance provisions to have two different areas within the buffer, what we're calling a Zone 1 and Zone 2, and I'll define those momentarily. But the important point for this slide is that for University Lake watershed, we're assuming that all of the, or recommending that all of the buffer would be in this most protected Zone 1 area in the intermittent and perennial streams. In the ephemeral streams, it would be similar to outside of the watershed, although we would have a wider buffer, 30 feet versus 15 feet. And then when we look at our uses and activities are allowed, we've put a lot of effort into developing all the language and provisions here to provide some uniformity and clarity and specificity and detail so that as questions come up about what is and is not allowable or how we can deal with different activities that might be considered in the buffers, that it's clear to all parties involved right up front. Buffer widths is something that when most people think about buffers, it's one of the first things. I'd like to suggest it is an important thing, but there's lots of other meat in this ordinance that I think really provides every bit as much importance. And I'll mention one provision in particular in a moment besides the width. But this is certainly the most publicly easy to understand and relate to. It's easy to map, and what I wanted to show here in this slide is that we're showing the widths for perennial streams, lakes, ponds, and reservoirs, intermittent streams, and I do have in your packet, there was an addition that was handed out tonight. In the draft version that we sent out Friday, we actually missed that we need to include in there intermittent ponds and ephemeral ponds. We want to make sure that we don't have a one-size-fits-all for all types of ponds. So the white values here are the proposed new buffer widths showing Zone 1 and Zone 2 for the area in the University Lake watershed and outside. So the proposed widths are shown here, and then the black numbers here are what we currently have, sort of, you know, highly aggregated and summarized, and what we've tried to do with our new buffer widths is be consistent with where we've been to the extent we can, and be consistent with the driving factor is we want to make sure our buffers are providing the water quality protection that we think is required. And then when we look at the buffers in their entirety, over using all these buffer widths for these streams, that we're buffering roughly the same amount of land that we are now. We're trying to maintain some level of equity, if you will, in not imposing largely greater or lesser buffers. We're not seeing that our current buffer width, our buffer area in its entirety, is biased in any way. So this is a balancing that we've done to get to this point, and I would also like to mention a couple of details here that in no case will any buffer be less extensive than the 100-year floodplain. And in addition, just by for point of reference, the draft Jordan Lake rules show a buffer width of 50 feet for both perennial and intermittent streams. So for perennial streams, you can compare that to this 100-foot value here. So we're twice as wide as the draft Jordan rules require, and we're 10 feet wider for intermittent streams. In addition, we're adding buffers for ephemeral streams, which aren't required in the Jordan Lake rules.
Could you go back to that? For, if I understand, the ones in black are what is current, correct?
Right.
And then so for the intermittent streams and ponds, there seems, for those that were formerly 100, you've reduced it by 40. And so if you could, and especially in the watershed, if you could provide explanation for that.
Okay. In the current rules for the watershed, let me pull those up here, but there's basically two sets of buffers, and one is for intermittent tributaries flowing directly to University Lake, and then the other is for intermittent tributaries not flowing directly to tributaries. And one of them is 50 feet and one of them is 100 feet.
And so the ones that don't flow are probably, they are 50 feet, and the ones that do flow are 100. Okay.
I had a question.
Yes, ma'am.
So, Randy, when I looked at this, it kind of suggested to me that the infiltration and the recharge area, the percentage actually goes up. Is that correct?
For the recommended buffers?
Right. In total, when you look at...
Well, the area available for infiltration and recharge is really, we've tried to be pretty neutral, and it's about the same, but the next part of the ordinance that I'll talk about, the diffuse flow provision, is really the important part for, really significantly improving our ability to encourage that.
Okay.
So as I mentioned, there's two zones, a streamside zone one, and the purpose of this zone is to protect the physical and ecological integrity of the stream. We're making sure the stream is well shaded. We're making sure that vegetation isn't disturbed near the stream, and that the habitat for the biota that live near the stream, in and near the stream, is intact and has as minimal disturbance as possible. Also in this zone, we're filtering the flow that comes through from zone two, which is more of a transitional zone. There's more activity allowed and more disturbance allowed, but it's still highly regulated within zone two. And the details of that are in various places in the draft ordinance, primarily in the table of allowable and exempt activities. But the important thing here is that when the water gets into zone one, we want it to be getting into zone one and have this opportunity to infiltrate so that we're not creating new gullies and erosion impacts into our creeks.
So what you're saying about zone two is supposed to be sort of the filter for zone one and to slow down the erosion or the ability to erode once it gets to zone one.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Can I add to that and kind of be a every person here? When I first read this, I thought that there were two zones, just like we have different zoning zones, right? But instead, what it is there are two zones together. So it's like part A and part B.
Yes.
And so you could think of part A as being closest to the stream and part B as kind of being the border.
Exactly.
So like the pre-buffer.
Exactly.
Right?
They're contiguous and completely one piece that's just partitioned right. into two different.
Yeah. I think you've done an amazing job, and I think you're really smart. And I'm not as – no, really. And like I'm not as smart as you, so sometimes when I read it, I don't quite get it. So maybe the part that – and this is not a criticism. It is not. The when we finally go public with this, if we would kind of explain the two zones that way, you know, in a way that's – that people who don't live this can kind of get it quicker. And I'm not diminishing the work. I think you've done an amazing job. It just needs to be dumbed down a little, so I can get it on the first reading, and other, because once that finally hit me, it just made so much sense to have kind of two different. I view it as sifting twice, you know.
So that's a good
analogy. Yeah. So once I saw it that way, it made sense. But thank you for your work on this.
Sure.
It's really good.
Thank you. Just wanted to provide some visual depictions here so you could sort of see the before our current buffers and the new buffers with a map. I want to very clearly preface this by saying this is using our GIS data, and our GIS data has recognized constraints with it. I won't go into all those details unless you're interested in them, but These are not regulatory maps. This is not what we would go out and work on a site plan. So here we're looking at the northern part of town. Lake Hogan Farms is just off the screen to the south here. The Twin Creeks Park area is up in here. Seeing Jones Creek coming up in Buckhorn Branch. So that's just to orient you as to where we are. Oops. This is adding the floodways and the floodplains to the map. So we have a floodway. The floodway is the main part of the flow during flood events, where most of the flow velocity happens. And then the floodplain is a broader area around that. So there's the floodway and the floodplain. Now we add our buffers, and you can see. I mean, there's a lot of overlap with the floodways and the floodplains, but they are their own entity. And there's just some nuances here, like the floodplains were remapped, and so there's places where there's some inconsistencies. You'll notice here we have a minor intermittent stream with a small buffer by the current ordinance, and remember when I show the next one how that changes. So this is our current buffers, what they look like now, if you can just kind of get that picture. And then this is the new buffers. And using our GIS data, so this isn't regulatory data, but here you can see our new, here we're actually calling this an intermittent stream with a larger buffer. Here's a place where the buffer is getting bigger. There's places where the buffer's getting smaller. You can see, like, over in here is an example. A lot of these ephemeral streams have been remapped. We have better information. This color right here is we don't think is as accurate as a depiction as these new ones.
Randy, would you just do one favor for me? I thought it was just because I didn't have my glasses. Could you read out some of the names of those streets that are crisscrossing on the southern end in the middle?
So this is Hogan Hills Road. This is Turtleback Crossing.
Oh, Turtleback, okay.
Tally Ho is right here, Renard.
And what's the one right below Renard?
Brace.
That's Brace, okay. And what is the one right north of Turtleback? Isn't there one right in...
Right in here?
No, to the west of it.
Lake Hogan...
No, right above that, isn't there?
It doesn't list the name, but it's those townhouses.
That's what I wanted to know, okay.
Yeah, it's a, what is that called? Jones Creek Place.
Randy, can you go back one, then come to this again one more time?
Yeah. Not bad.
Current buffers and floodplain, floodway. Mm-hmm. Our best guess is the new buffers. And we have a map posted on our website with the entirety of town. You can, on a PDF file, you can zoom in and get a lot of detail. We did work out some statistics of this for the three different areas of town using our GIS. Again, these are GIS data, just to get some sense of how much are we going to change. So in the northern transition area, we're currently, our current buffers, if you just take the footprint of the buffers, is totaling up 534 acres, which is about 20% of the total area of the northern transition area. With our proposed buffers, we're actually going down a little bit. About, when you look at the entirety of the area, it's about 2%. Now, I would want to clarify that a good deal of this difference, just when I visually looked at it, is in areas that have already been developed. Windmore, Claremont, et cetera. And so we're not suggesting here that necessarily there's sort of 57 unprotected acres. In fact, the way that these articulate with other parts of the ordinance, there's provisions for our open space protection, et cetera, that, you know, that's important to remember. Outside of the northern transition area, we're actually increasing the amount of that's in buffered areas, and in the watershed, we're actually decreasing a little bit when you add it all up. Now, in the watershed, these buffers include buffering of University Lake itself, and that's why we're seeing these percentages actually somewhat larger.
Real quickly, or maybe not real quickly, the Northern Transition Area Advisory Committee had some concerns about these numbers, and for the rest of you on the board, it's attachment E7. Mm-hmm. And their main concern, and this is kind of, I think, what we need to know about, is it said, instead of significant reductions have been made to the buffers that currently exist in the northern transition area in the name of conformity. These reductions, which total 60 acres of land, single out the northern transition area without any further justification and without apparently establishing other protective regulations that address other values and reasons for maintaining the existing buffer sizes. I think that's something we really, and I know you have this whole chart about that, but
right.
that one question in looking at the previous chart, I think we kind of need to deal with.
Right. I'd actually prepared a slide today specifically trying to respond to the comments we got from the Northern Transition Area Advisory Committee. And on this point, which I think is captured mostly here in 3 and perhaps some in 4, when you look at our protection of open space, wildlife corridors, and those kind of things that are mentioned in the Northern Transition Area Committee's comment, and compare those protections are all provided in a separate section of the ordinance, the open space section of the ordinance, and staff actually did study this, and our opinion is that these changes are neutral, and it has to do with the details of how it's worded, but actually the primary constraints in 15.198 as provided with stream buffers is currently listed as 60 feet for stream buffers. And so as an example, if we had a stream buffer that was wider than 60 feet based on how our ordinance is worded and required with the slope-based width, et cetera, that extra width could be in our development process, could be protected, but it's also possible, you know, the details of the activities that are allowed and exempt and so forth, we don't have that detail in the ordinance currently. So one example is that there's been occasions where stormwater management devices have been placed inside of a stream buffer. Therefore, you know, the open space protection kind of amenities, the stream buffers in that case aren't providing that protection. So that's one response. A second response is that staff does have this part of the ordinance on our radar for revision and review. to make sure that these kind of concerns that the NTA, you know, are recognized and that we don't let some things slip through the cracks. And finally, you know, I just wanted to reiterate that this is a GIS estimate, that's 57 acres, and based on the numbers and looking at it, it's a pretty small percentage of the land that's at risk, and it's actually something much smaller than 57 acres because some of that's already been developed and isn't at risk of being compromised in the future. Does that help?
Yeah, I think as we move forward, though, we're going to need to make sure that that's real clear and that something doesn't happen where people then come running up and saying, see, if we hadn't made this change, that wouldn't have happened. That's what we need to really be on our guard about.
Are you done with you? I have a question, but if are you done?
I have a couple more points I can make, if that's okay.
Rapidly.
I did want to mention the diffuse flow provision. This is the shortest and sweetest in the draft ordinance. And I just wanted to show the language here to the maximum extent practicable and in consideration of topography and existing uses, diffuse flow of runoff at non-erosive velocity shall be established. I mean, this is an important new provision, and I just wanted to provide some visuals of why it's important. We're looking at a stormwater outfall. Actually, it's while the device is in a construction phase as a sediment erosion control device, and so the runoff coming out is rather turbid. But here's an outfall from a stormwater device flowing through a buffer. And in essence, the buffer is providing no water quality treatment. It's just a straight channel to the stream. This is an example of in Chapel Hill off of Hillsborough Street where there's a big stormwater outfall, actually not that big a stormwater outfall off of a street. And over decades of use, because there is no protection for the buffer and no diffuse flow established, you get this kind of gullying. This is an outfall to Morgan Creek off of a parking lot. And the standard practice here was to put riprap at the outfalls. And you can see it's now kind of growing up in forest again. And then as you go farther downstream, you start getting some ditches and gullying and active erosion happening. And this is what we're trying to abate. There's a variety of ways we can do it. This is an example out of Pacifica where they took a pretty small part of their site, but with some really low-tech landscaping and installed this device that basically the water comes in and is established as a sheet flow instead of flowing in one channel coming out of there. So the only other points I want to make, we have presented this to, as required by the land use ordinance, the joint planning agreement, and general statutes to the planning board, Orange County, and DWQ. And we've also passed this by all of our advisory boards, as well as utilities, because there are provisions in here that are specific to utilities. I have some responses here from the NTAA AC comments. They're also provided in your packet, and I don't necessarily need to reiterate them other than just say, you know, we completely agree with the importance of providing educational material as part of all of this. We think that this language in the ordinance provides, instead of unnecessary complexity, we think after we can get over a learning curve, that actually hopefully it'll be a clearer, because of the clarity of purpose that we have here, and because, you know, sometimes more words, at first they may be more, but in the long run they may be beneficial. And there's a lot of universal language in here that is becoming adopted so that professionals who are familiar with what's going on in Chapel Hill or other jurisdictions can be in tune with what we're doing here. And so I think I did want to mention a question that's come up with staff is, well, we've got our existing ordinance, and if this becomes adopted, we have these active projects, and you know, which ones will they fall under? And the language as it's drafted in here is to provide flexibility so that these applications can be looked at as to whether it would be most beneficial to have them under the existing ordinance or under the future ordinance. These are the projects that staff has identified that are likely of interest. And other words, I just have, you know, there's just some information here about the structure of the ordinance. We're repealing three sections for the three different parts of town. And we're repealing a section of the ordinance that has to do with setbacks and crossings in the University Lake watershed. We're modifying the language for variances, have some very minor modifications or amendments to the open space section. And then, most importantly, we're creating eight new sections that comprehensively looks at our ordinance. We did follow our standard public hearing notice procedures, both for the original notice and in January, and then again this month. And we have included information on our website as well, including maps of the current and proposed buffers. So our staff recommendation is to adopt a resolution finding consistency and also adopt the draft ordinance as presented. Now, we just mentioned that there were some very minminor edits that were passed around that would be part of, if you choose to adopt it, would be included. So thank you very much for your time. I know that was a lot of information.
Joel, Lydia, Dan.
On attachment E2, the November 17th responses for the Orange County Planning and Inspections Department, could you comment, or someone on staff comment, on paragraphs 4, 5, and 6?
I'll make a comment, and then if anyone else wants to, that'd be great. In our original draft of this, and I believe it was the draft that the county actually reviewed, we included some language regarding forestry activities, and we subsequently have removed those. So I think we responded positively to number 4 here. Is there an add-in rule? Well, yes, I think we're compliant with number 5, too, because we are, by reference, defining intermittent and perennial streams based on the state's definition.
Okay.
Then as far as enforcement and penalties.
And just like we handle other enforcement and penalties.
Mike, do you have any?
Yeah, okay. Yes, just like we handle everything else. Okay. So you don't need to specifically deal with that.
Okay, no problem at all. One other question. And I think, and so I understand correctly, if you are found to be an existing non-conforming situation and your house burns down, can you rebuild your house? I think I asked this question.
Without a variance.
Without a variance.
98% sure the answer is yes, but let me.
Okay.
The attorney will get back to us.
Okay, no problem. That's all for me.
Lydia.
Yeah, Randy, the email from Carolyn Buckner, maybe that's one of the papers you were talking about, but there were two or three points that she brought up, you know, and these were under the allowable activities. One had to do with under the temporary sediment and erosion control devices, and I'm not certain that
on page 9.
Yeah, on page 9 of 23, but she actually says delete zone 1 from the second bullet. She might mean zone 1 from the second sentence.
I believe that comment was carried over from a review of a previous version, and we updated that.
I don't see it in the second bullet.
Exactly.
Okay. And the second thing is under temporary roads, which is on page 13 of 23, She suggests changing the two bolded activities from exempt and allowable to allowable with mitigation. Did you all discuss that?
We did discuss that as staff, and we did not recommend, we did not come to a conclusion to that we were in agreement with that point.
What's your sense of, in either case, either the smaller designation or the larger, is mitigation required? And is it just your feeling that a temporary road does not have that much impact, or?
Well, I'm trying to refresh my thoughts of the discussion that happened amongst staff at that point in time.
Well, maybe the restoration activities are sufficient. Is that perhaps?
I think the fact that it's a temporary situation means that it's to go through the, particularly the allowable with mitigation, is a pretty, onerous is a strong word, but it's a pretty, significant undertaking that that for these kind of temporary situations that, there just wasn't the sense with staff, and as we talked about, that it was worth the trouble.
Even for the greater than 2,500? The third point, I guess you understand this, staff updating stream crossing standards to be consistent with the recommendations of the North Carolina Stream Restoration Institute. Is that something you would do anyway?
Well, I believe that what Carolyn's referring to here regards the details of the engineering of stream crossings, what kind of either bridge or culvert design would be included. And that's not something that's we've tried to tackle in this particular piece. We're looking at the land area adjacent to a stream. We're not looking at necessarily, the crossing itself as part of this. Other than that, there in the transportation section of this table, there are mention of these different thresholds of crossings in terms of what is exempt, allowable, or allowable with mitigation, but we're not trying to get into the specific engineering of how that crossing is done. And the Stream Restoration Institute does have recommendations about span bridges and arch culverts and bottomless culverts and that sort of thing, and I think that's really the essence of that comment.
Okay. Thank you.
The answer is that they can be replaced. Replaced, rebuilt, replaced.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm good.
I just want to make sure. I have a question about on the buffers that would be introduced for what you're calling ephemeral streams. Let me make sure first I've got my facts correct. So right now we don't actually have any buffer requirements for ephemeral streams. Is that right?
Well, we have. They're different in different parts of town. We're calling them minor intermittent streams. So the
keep going back.
Yeah, the definitions. We're upgrading our basic definition of stream. So this is our existing regulations and. So here, we can see we aren't calling anything in ephemeral streams. There are no ephemeral streams in the University Lake watershed. Our ephemeral streams, some of these less than 50 acres will be intermittent, some of them will be ephemeral.
I got you.
And then here we are distinguishing between intermittent and minor intermittent, but it's not necessarily, the standard terminology that's used.
Okay. Okay. That's a helpful clarification. So it's partly an issue of, no, we don't literally have a buffer for
for that particular term, but then it's just because it doesn't mean there is no buffer. It means that that term doesn't have a meaning under the current ordinance.
Correct.
I guess what I'm wondering about, or what I'm trying to get to, is to what extent does this put into place? I realize this adjusts the nature and to some small degree the scope, the total length or number of feet of buffer. But to what extent does this change the changes that we would be making place buffers around bodies of water that currently have no, or streams or intermittent streams or whatever you want to call them, that have essentially no buffer right now? Do you see what I'm asking?
Yes. I mean, it's really.
I'm trying to picture, for example, somebody owns a vacant lot in Carborough that has some kind of, you know, are there people who are going to suddenly have some buffer to deal with where they had no buffer to deal with before?
It's actually doubtful, and let me explain why. Currently, these less than 50-acre drainage area and minor intermittent streams, we do include buffers on all streams that the town recognizes as streams. And the way we do that currently is to go out in the field and I'll use the term morphologically. I mean, basically, if you can see that there's a concentration of flow happening, then that can be considered as a stream.
Mm-hmm.
And these can be some very, very small streams. And so we have identified a number of those, and they do include buffers on them. What we're proposing with this change is to define a threshold for a drainage area to define when a stream becomes an ephemeral stream, and we're recommending that threshold at 5 acres. And so it will streamline our process in part, but I think it will also provide more clarity. And the essential rationale for that 5-acre threshold is at a smaller areas than that, we really want to use the stormwater provisions in our ordinance as our primary management tool. And then once we get above that, we're starting to really, you know, start to deal with a more natural system, and one that's more worthy of some kind of protection via buffers.
Okay. Jackie?
Would you please go to, it's one of the slides towards the end, of the projects that will be exempt because they've already started.
That's it.
Okay. So take, for instance, the minor subdivision on Old Pittsboro Road. What would be the difference in which version of the ordinance they came in under?
I haven't personally looked at that project, and I don't think Jeff is here. I don't know.
Okay, or maybe on Carolina Commons or Collinton Cross, or just could you just pick one of them and explain what would be the net effect difference? Because for me to vote for this, I need to understand how it's going to affect people and how it's going to affect development, how it's going to add to the cost, if it's going to add to the cost of development, if it's going to make our housing projects more elite by being more expensive, if it's going to, you know, and it's the intermittent streams that I'm mainly concerned about, if that's going to make some property undevelopable. So if you could just pick one and explain to me, or somebody could, what the difference would be under the two ordinances in what they can and can't do with their property.
Yeah, well, they're each unique, and
okay.
So there'd be some difference if we were to look at different ones. But the first point with these particular ones is just to reiterate that
they're exempt.
We're providing flexibility,
right.
So they would just be examples of what could be seen in the future.
Gotcha.
There's really minimal impact. I'll just speak to one or two that I'm familiar with. There's really minimal impact for Lloyd Harbor. The Colleton Crossing, we never, I should say, I never looked at it with this question in mind about the before and after because it came in under the current ordinance. And I can tell you that the buffer is narrower on that property with the new rules, but we also have this table of allowable and exempt and with mitigation and, and very specific things about what is and isn't okay.
Yeah.
And so there may have been some difference, and then there's the diffuse flow piece. So we may have requested that the applicant engineer that site differently, and you know it might have had some difference in terms of the footprint of how lots got laid out and so forth.
Okay.
If I could kind of a little bit. So regardless of necessarily exactly the specifics on those projects or similar projects, I mean, overall, I guess I'm wondering, you know, how much more difficult to comply with or expensive to comply with would do you think that the new rules are versus the old rules? Or is there a notable difference? And maybe I should be asking that question to that grim row of engineers back there.
Well, difficult and expensive. So in terms of clarity, I think it makes the communication between staff and the applicants much better with this proposed regulations. In terms of expensive, I mean, I haven't specifically tried to cost out that, and so it would be premature for me to really weigh in. But just thinking offhand, I mean, I can't think of any reason why this would be necessarily providing, you know, significant additional financial hardship. The diffuse flow requirement will require attention to that transition from the development into the buffer that could require some grading or some a BMP in addition to a BMP that might have been required, might not have been required previously. It's possible in some scenarios there could be a marginal decrease in the because of the area that would be required for those BMPs. You know, there might be a marginal decrease in the buildable area, if you will. Although it's a very site by site determination. In some cases, we're allowing development to move downslope some, so there's more developable area possibly. So it's a very site-specific question, and you know my just overall general reaction is that there isn't any inherent intention to be biased to, you know, ratchet down, if you will, so that these will be more difficult and more expensive requirements to meet.
This question might get to some of these questions that Mark and Jackie were asking, but can you envision a scenario? Have you thought about one that might be one that might fall under this no practical alternative part of this ordinance? I mean, is there anything particular you thought out, or is that just kind of a catch-all for something that just may not absolutely fit, but there might be a compelling reason to allow it?
Sounds like Mike Throw to me.
I'm not. No practical alternative. You're talking about the definition of what it takes to be allowable.
Well, this one section, determination of no practical alternatives. It's, I guess, a determination under which a permit can still proceed if the permit authority, the permit issuing authority, makes such a determination. Is that just a?
Well, I mean, basically, it gets kicked in by this table of.
Right.
Activities, and so you know, if there was some particular activity, and there's a whole suite of them here, if there was some particular activity that on a given development site was desirable to include, and between the applicant and the staff, we just couldn't really figure out how to make it work without going this route, then it kicks in this requirement in the ordinance, which is basically, you know, giving staff the ability to have some leverage, if you will, some approval authority.
Let me just add one thing that I don't take credit for in this respect.
I only said it sounded like.
Well, that's right. I guess it does. Actually, I would have said practicable rather than practical.
Yeah,
but anyway,
exactly. Should have known.
But that's right. It's a bigger word. I like it. But the structure here. One of the main objectives was to pick up the structure that is now sort of common parlance in these kinds of ordinances as they are being generated, if you will, or required, in effect, by the state. So the regulations that you see here, these are very similar to what, and Henry can probably verify this, he probably sees these in a lot of other areas and jurisdictions, which are covered by other state rules. We're going to get the Jordan rules, and I think the Jordan rules, there may be changes to them, but probably not in this part. And so this language is trying to pick up the concepts that they have used as much as possible. And that whole framework of saying something is either having this chart with these things that are listed, we made some modifications in it, but essentially it's derived from this Jordan rules language, and that concept of having something as being either exempt, meaning you don't have to justify it at all as an intrusion on the buffer, or allowable, meaning you've got to show it's possible, but you've got to show a good justification, or allowable with mitigation. All that's coming. I didn't invent any of that. We just picked all that language right up. The only thing we modified was some of the categories is where we put the X's in the boxes and some of the listings that didn't make sense for us. But the basic structure of it is coming. We're not, you know, when the Jordan rules get here, we're not going to have much choice about that. That's what they're going to require. And so that's kind of what we've done. And also, it made sense to us in terms of getting the clarity. But it is language that, the people who work in this field are going to be very familiar with.
Every time... I just mean this factually. Every time we add a new layer of regulation, it eventually impacts the cost of housing and the cost of doing development and the ease of doing development. And one of the things we hear over and over again, particularly when it comes to water runoff, is how many times somebody has to go back through the engineer. And we've heard that for years, that it's over and over and over again. So I don't know if this is going to make that simpler or if it's going to compound it. But I feel like this is something we need to do. I think it's important. I think it's very well thought out. I need to know more detail about its on-the-ground impact on new developments coming in, like in terms of how it will affect the process, how it will affect the cost, how it will affect the amount of land available for development. And I feel like I need to know those things in order to vote on this, because I have to understand the impact on my community of what I'm voting for. And so I'd like to see some examples and some compare and contrast of what this impact's going to be, because anybody watching this who's in the building industry is going to say, well, what's this mean to us?
Right.
You know?
But we just heard that it doesn't mean anything to anyone in the building industry unless they're looking at a specific site, and then that site will either have a different requirement or a greater or a lesser.
Yeah, but when you look at the map and you look at those itty-bitty streams, I don't feel like that's a sufficient answer.
Well, that's
a little too broad.
Could I ask the engineer to come up for a minute? From
your point of view, does this seem like this is going to be, basically a simpler system to apply and enforce, or a more complicated system, or what?
I think it's going to be a little simpler. Right now, the buffer requirements are a little bit vague. It's vague as to whether there is a buffer or not a buffer on a stream. This puts a buffer on a stream, and it states clearly what the buffer is going to be, what you can do in the buffer, and it gives you different things to do in the different zones. So in that respect, I think it will be easier for the engineers to bring things to us. It's not going to change the design. They're still going to have to do 85% TSS removal. They're still going to have to do the detention. It's just going to have to be done outside of the buffer rather than inside the buffer. Some of it is done inside the buffer at present time. So that, to me, will be the biggest impact to the property itself, is that you'll still be able to do it, and I think you will, in the open space. You'll still be able to use the open space for some of these BMPs. Is that correct? Outside of the buffers.
So is it decreasing?
Yes, they're saying back there.
Is it decreasing the amount of buildable land?
Probably not, because, as I say, they'll probably be using the open space for most of the BMPs.
Okay.
So it's just if the site is so constrained that most of it is in a buffer, then yeah, it will impact it. But if you've got a large site that you've got a lot of open space, you've got 40% open space, you're going to have to designate anyway,
mm-hmm.
and you can put your BMPs in those areas, then I don't see it really being an impact.
I have a question to follow up on what Jackie's asking. So potentially, this goes back to the downslopes. So potentially downslopes could be considered in a buildable area now where they were not before.
I don't know. I had to look at Marty for that one, too. The constraints that are put on the sites for steep slopes, I don't know if you'd be able to build in a steep slope area anyway. So.
Could you repeat the question? Trish and I were still back on the last question.
Oh, okay. You know, the question of the downslopes maybe not being included in buffer as it currently exists, does that mean that some of that downslope area might be considered for building, for development?
Buildable area?
Yeah.
If it qualifies as a steep slope, 25% or greater slope, then in a residential subdivision, it would have to be set aside as non-buildable area. Any way you slice this, it would be non-buildable. It may be located on a private lot in certain situations, but it would have to be denoted on the plat as non-buildable area, effectively like a slope buffer. We don't call it that, but that's in effect what it is. If it is a non-subdivision, though, such as a commercial project, then that does not necessarily apply in that situation. I don't know, you know, downtown we don't have too many steep slopes, so I don't know that there's too many places where that would have an effect, but is that helpful?
But this does change the delineation of downslope. Downslope is no longer considered, you know, definitely inside the buffer, correct?
It was not previously, though.
Okay.
They've always been differentiated as two different things. The one thing I think that is changing relative to slopes with this ordinance would be where certain buffers currently are measured off of or based on a slope, how steep the slope is. So that is changing, but the steep slope itself, at least for residential subdivisions, will still be preserved as non-buildable.
Okay.
I hope I'm not confusing things.
No, okay. No. It's. But I do think that that's one point to help make clear to folks, because I do think that's confusing, the question of the downslopes.
This has been an interesting discussion. Jackie sounds like she's not ready to vote on this issue right now, or anyway, not necessarily comfortable voting for it. If we are going to vote right now, what is the board's pleasure about whether we're going to vote on this tonight or not?
Well, I'm ready to vote for it, and I want to clarify with Jackie, though. I mean, you were saying you needed more information on some impacts, but that you liked the ordinance is what I heard you say. So are you not wanting to vote for it tonight?
I understand the need for the ordinance.
Uh-huh.
I have a feeling that not many people, I think this can have an impact, and I don't think many people are aware of the impact that it can have. And sometimes with really complicated, thick things, we get into a situation where we pass it, and then afterwards we hear, oh, well, that's what you passed, you know, 2 or 3 years down the line, as the implications begin to surface. Mm-hmm. Or the community will say, well, what'd you pass that for? It does this and this and this and this, you know? And because nobody has spoken at this public hearing about this.
And incidentally, if I could interrupt you for 1 second, is there anybody here who, I don't have anybody signed up, but did anybody come to speak on this subject to us? Okay, thanks.
See, so I'm a little worried that we're not, that I don't understand enough about its impact in the development process. And I'm a little worried that people didn't understand what it really was when they heard that there was a public hearing. It's not the kind of thing that draws people out. But maybe after hearing our conversation tonight and reading about it, that there will be some people who have a response. And I frankly need to see it in a little simpler language, and I need to really understand how it's going to affect development. Is it going to decrease the number of units that somebody can build? Is it going to add to the amount of engineering that they have to have done, or the number of times they have to have meetings with the engineers? I just need to know that. The rest of you feel comfortable with that, go ahead and vote. I can't vote for it until I understand that. And really, to pass something really complicated without much public input can come back and kind of bite you on the toes later on, or other parts.
Or worse places.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and move attachment A then, with that noted, that concern.
I'll second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. I do think it is a little surprising to me that nobody's here to speak at this public hearing. Like, I can't believe nobody has an opinion about this, but
well, you know, Mark, I mean, you know, I think this is the fourth or fifth time I've seen it.
Well, that's true.
It's been here once. It's been in the recreation and parks. It's been here twice. It's been in the recreation and parks. It's been the planning board once or twice. It's had, even though it doesn't have citizens here tonight, I think there's been a lot of review of it.
And typically with all ordinances, there are always unintended consequences.
You know that.
That we don't anticipate. And if I feel like the board and future boards would be responsive if there was an unintended consequence that didn't meet the town's vision, I guess. And, you know, I'm always skeptical about some of what we require developers to do, but on the other hand, they make a good case for it.
Well,
that's just me.
Okay.
I think I agree that this has been seen a couple of times. I think folks have had a chance to digest it. I think Jackie's point is well taken. It does take a bit to digest it. And for those of us who have seen it a couple of times, and even those folks who are very concerned about the creeks and the health of the creeks and the surrounding areas, I think Randy did an excellent job of explaining how these changes, especially in the description and definition of the types of surface waters, really help in limiting the erosion and sedimentation of the surface waters. So, but I do agree that it does take time to kind of process this information. I would hope that there's some educational material that can go with this, that maybe even on the website there could be. I really like that diagram that shows the wider protection. I think that says so much, and maybe with just and people are real visual. If they see that and they see a small captioned explanation of it underneath, they'll understand, you know, what that means. That and the definitions of the new definitions of the creek status, surface water credit.
So it looks like it'll pass because John's votes are all affirmative since he's left.
Yes. John wasn't feeling well, and he went home. One second. You moved this?
Yes.
Were there some technical corrections that were put before us tonight?
I assume that the
That's
resolution refers to the corrected version.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Right. With pond.
Okay. All right. So right. With that, I just want to make sure that that's what we're doing. Hold on one second. Go ahead.
I neglected to mention a piece of this here, and that is that the Environmental Management Commission actually has to give final approval because of the University Lake watershed, the fact that that's in our jurisdiction. So, you know,
this is not actually the end of the line.
The effective date will be the effective date that they approve it.
Okay. And Trish, did you have something apart from that you wanted to point out?
But it just needs to clarify A1 or A2.
A2.
A1 is the one supporting the item, and then B is the draft ordinance itself.
Oh, okay. Right. So the motion we're on is actually the resolution of consistency.
Right.
Is that right?
Right.
Yes.
That's your point. Okay.
That's so A1.
Yeah, that's A1.
A1, yeah. Okay. The other thing I'll just point out is we did receive a very supportive email, very supportive of this from the Friends of Bowling mm-hmm. Creek late today. It raised some questions, and they were essentially identically the questions that Carolyn Buckner had emailed about and that were addressed a few minutes ago. So I just wanted to point that out. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the resolution of consistency has A1 has been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously.
Move the ordinance.
Second.
With the corrections.
With the corrections.
From staff.
The corrected ordinance.
All those, it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, the matter passes.
Nope.
6-1. Thanks, Joe. All right. We are on to item A3, a public hearing for conditional use permit request for arbors at Winmore.
Okay. Marty Roop is making his way to give the presentation on this. If it's okay with the board, if he could go ahead and cover the next two items because they are related, it would save some time.
Hold on one second. Okay, if that's all right with the attorney.
And we're being asked to vote tonight because of the tax credit issue. Is that right?
Yeah.
Timing issue.
It is a timing issue.
It's okay. Been suggested that we take a 3-minute break.
That's a good idea.
Can we consolidate the 3 minutes into one?
No, we cannot.
we're going to take a 3-minute break, and we'll be right back.
let me find George Sazier. That's some early.
Other than being so mad at them, all I can think about Friday night watching the game was having to see George this week.
What is the school?
Cleveland State.
Cleveland State.
Oh, really?
Vikings.
Randy.
It's 215 days.
For your team.
For my team.
I will not get emotionally involved.
Yeah, all right.
Until the first
tip-off. Okay, I'm on the 10.
All right, now that's the truth there.
Or before.
All right, Mr. Manager.
Marty Roop is ready, I believe. Marty.
Sure. And I've been asked to make it brief. I do have a presentation to show you, but I'll try and get through it pretty quickly. We're here to consider a conditional use permit for the arbors at Winmore. Vicinity map. Where's the laser? Winmore. Homestead Road is over here just off screen. And this is what originally was known as Lot 99 within Winmore, as shown in purple here. I'm going to just go over some facts, and I'll try to make it quick. I'll try to do so quickly. This did require a full CUP review because the original Winmore permit left this lot essentially undesigned. Most of the Winmore village was designed to consider stormwater and all applicable issues and fully engineered, et cetera, during the original approval, but this was one of two lots that was left out of that. So it did undergo a full CUP review. They had to address stormwater regulations and all of the ordinance, basically. 0.95 acres, 41,000 approximately square feet of land, and they're proposing 22 units. It was originally approved for 24 units, so there's two fewer on this site, but there is actually an increase on the other site, the South Camellia site, which I have one presentation to just get through here, but I'll talk about both projects. I'll get to the South Camellia site. All affordable rental units receiving North Carolina tax credits, and Dean Edwards, the applicant, is here, can explain in detail how the tax credit program works if you so desire. I'll just note that the applicant and Orange Community Housing and Land Trust have worked out an agreement wherein the units will transfer to the land trust upon expiration of the tax credits, thereby ensuring the 100-year conformance to our ordinance, the provisions related to affordable housing. Open space and recreation facilities were satisfied by the original Winmore permit, but there is a clubhouse facility proposed as a part of this application, as required as a part of the tax credit program. Here's the site. That's a close-up of the site. I'm going to run through a few elements of the site plan, but I won't spend too much time on it. The two areas blocked out in yellow are where the actual units would be located, basically a row of units here, and then a multifamily building in this location, and the clubhouse would be basically in the middle.
Where's the closest non-Winmore house to those? I know it's on the Hogan Farm side, but where is the closest house?
Like Turtleback Crossing or something?
Yeah,
or no.
I can't say it very specifically, but
so
over
it's not very
to the
close
west
to any particular.
I don't
single
think so. Can anyone else help me out?
I couldn't tell from that whether.
I can pull up an aerial if you'd like.
So they'd be Winmore houses.
Winmore, there's definitely a row of Winmore houses there.
So they're really not. I don't need a lot of time on this. They're really not abutting any Hogan Farm houses or very close to them?
No.
Not directly.
It's some like sparsely developed parcels that are just south of Lake Hogan Farms.
That's all I need, Marty.
Okay.
That's fine. Thanks.
I'll let this come
the
up
blockers
if we want to
over there
go back to it. Okay. Where was I? Back to the show. Okay.
This just shows, and I guess to speak to what you were just asking, the most immediate houses are basically directly on the other side of the alleyway. Mm-hmm. And the alleyway does provide the way in and out of this site in two locations, over here on the west and on the east. There's a sidewalk system in front of all the units, a little trail down here that connects to a trail down in this area off of their lot. And parking areas are 90-degree parking in here. It's kind of difficult to see that on this slide. Parallel parking here, and then a parking lot over here. 28 spaces are proposed to serve 22 units. Since the units are all affordable, there's the presumptive requirement is only one space per unit, so they're slightly exceeding the presumptive requirement. The landscape plan, they're providing an ample landscape plan. I've not highlighted every bush and tree that they are proposing, but just dotted some of the bigger ones in green to give you a kind of a sample of what it's going to feel like. But as you can see here, there's many, many more plantings shown on this plan. And so it does comply with the screening and shading. Oh, actually, Jackie, excuse me, Ms. Giss, speaking to what you were asking about before,
yeah.
On the west side, they are required to do a type A screen because over in that direction, there is a single family house, but I don't believe it's immediately adjacent to the property.
Okay.
Marty, can you point out the retaining wall that the planning board is asking that there be the safety railing on?
Yes, right in here. Is that correct, Brandon? Is that the right location?
Yeah, it's all along there.
Okay. Grading and stormwater. The stormwater device will be located under the parking lot, as shown here. And we have one CUP condition, or a few CUP conditions, a couple of boilerplate ones, and then one additional one related to that. The refuse and recycling area is up here directly adjacent to the transmission tower. A few miscellaneous items. They did conduct a neighborhood information meeting back in January. A few people showed up but didn't have any particular concerns. They can tell you more about that if you wish to hear. There was at the request to set the public hearing, there was a request from the board to receive an update related to commercial activities in Winmore. That's found as attachment E in your package. And there was one email received from a citizen that's found as attachment G. I have the conditions here if we want to discuss them, any particular ones in detail. Otherwise, I'll keep moving forward. Also, the advisory board recommendations.
Marty, can we just go back to the advisory board recommendations for a minute? On the landscaping, the EAB noted that the an interest in relocating the foundation plants closer to the sidewalk because of the alleyway. And maybe you want to clarify that back on that diagram, because we had a lengthy discussion in EAB about the fact that the alleyway really, what is directly across from it is the back of the homes. So they'd be looking at somebody's backyard if their foundation plants are right next to the townhomes, rather than if they were up against the sidewalk, they would have that feeling of having their own space, which, you know, I thought was a real thoughtful way of looking at their townhome space.
Yes.
And which is kind of a departure from how we usually see these kinds of things.
Well, I think you explained it fairly well. and we did, just to point out for others that may not know what we're talking about, the north side of the row of homes, I started to say townhomes, but technically they're not townhomes, does show a planting plan that, as suggested, basically has all the plantings up near the facade, and then a sidewalk, and then the alleyway, and so you basically have a line of sight over here. So the idea was to flip that and put the sidewalk and create kind of a courtyard area where you currently see these green circles, and put the plantings out closer to the alleyway. And Brandon and I did discuss that. I don't know if it's timely now for him to address that, but I imagine he's prepared to address it.
I'll say that we want the sidewalk beside the parking lot, so you get out of your car, you walk under the sidewalk.
So.
Yeah, but the sidewalk doesn't change. It's just whether the foundation plants are against the foundation of the structure or close to the sidewalk.
And it has to be sworn.
Right. I'm just clarifying.
I'm Brian DePence, John McAdams.
Hold on. You just need to be sworn.
Yeah.
Right.
You can, we can do both of you
at
once
if
you'd like. Good. Just state your names. Do you solemnly swear or affirm the evidence you're about to give us the truth to the best of your knowledge?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank
yes, ma'am.
You.
And I'm Dean Edwards, Vice President for Crossland.
You want to speak to that?
Yeah, go ahead. Start, okay. Brandon. I'll...
Obviously, we don't want to flip the sidewalk. We've discussed it. I don't think it's something that we would prefer to do simply because there are foundation planting requirements for the building.
We do have that design issue with the NCHFA and the tax credit requirements for their design quality as far as plantings around the foundations. However, with the hopefully with the tree plantings that we have along the alleyway and the larger trees that we intended to use, that will help screen that. So if we could have some leeway as to the types of plantings there to help screen it, we'd be glad to address it in that way.
Is there a way that you can, in addition to the trees, put something that also adds some lower screening to give that sense? Because the problem is the sight line conveys that it's looking into other people's backyards and their garages, actually.
The garages?
Yeah, yeah, and which I think, you know, garage. That does not suggest to me the kind of quality that we want folks to feel when they're in those homes.
Well, they've got really nice garages in Winmore, though.
Excuse me. But do you know what I'm saying? There might be some smaller plantings that help to make that space feel defined with the trees.
I understand what you're saying. I'm not sure how we accomplish it and what kind of plantings that we can use to do it. However, we can certainly work with staff if that's something that we could work with at a staff level to try to accomplish that look or a more polished look for you. And that's the best I think we can do for it based on our restrictions with HFA and tax credits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you guys have any other?
Well, Marty wasn't done.
Oh. Right.
I was actually going to flip over and talk about South Camellia quickly.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, then I have one more.
Yeah, I have a question about this. Or should we wait until they're done with Marty's done with everything?
Yeah, I don't want to go into the next
Depends
one.
Depends on what your question is, I guess.
I just wanted to support the Environmental Advisory Board and the Planning Board's recommendations about bike racks, especially since we just had the bicycle plan, but making sure that the bike racks are plentiful enough to accommodate the residences.
Yeah,
at one bike per residence, right, minimum.
And I would make the same comment about the with staff. I'd like to be able to work with staff as to the placement of those bike racks and be glad to accommodate, you know, where they'd like to see those placed.
That was my comment also, and you're going to try to do what you can to see that they're covered.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
The covered areas, we've looked back, and in fact, when I was here before, I said I thought we had room for covered bike racks in the breezeway portion of this particular building. We looked back, and because of this new design, we do not. However, I'd like to, again, work with staff to place the bike racks where you'd like to see them, and just point out the fact that we do have a fairly large storage facility or storage closet for each unit on their decks that could hang bikes, and we'd like for that to be able to be sufficient for covered areas. I don't see where we can provide covered bike racks at this point in time, but I'd be glad to work with staff to see about, you know, where we can place the other racks.
Okay. I know there's strong sentiment to keep pursuing that however you can.
Right.
Yeah. And how about this recommendation by the Planning Board to include a safety rail along the top of the retaining wall?
Yes.
Is that
by code we really actually have to produce that rail, and I can show you basically a quick photo of something that we normally would use on the pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This type of heavy duty aluminum rail has to be at anything over 32 inches anyway, so we usually use a picket fence that is has the strength that meets code to top off any retaining walls that might have a problem.
That's, you're saying that's a state building code type
Code issues that I think it's anything over 32 inches high is going to have that.
So it doesn't seem like we need
rail
a,
anyway.
We don't need that.
Right.
But this is exactly what we're going to be using.
Okay.
Great. Thank
right.
you.
Thanks. Marty. Camellia, whatnot.
Okay, I made it through all of that. Okay, Griffith's Landing, CUP minor modification along South Camellia Street. Just a few factual things to get through here, and I will be done soon. It is considered minor modification of the original Winmore CUP. This site also originally was slated for 24 units in a multifamily apartment building. The applicant and the Winmore developer agreed to convert 8 market-rate townhomes that were directly north of the multifamily site to an additional multifamily building for affordable housing. So while the other one went from 24 down to 22, the other site, this site is going from 24 up to 36 and involves a little additional land than was originally shown as the affordable area. On balance, the number of affordable units is increasing from 48 units to 58 units. Again, they're all affordable rental units via the tax credit program. And again, all 58 units would be transferred to the land trust upon expiration of the tax credits. Open space and recreation facilities, again, satisfied by the overall Winmore project. Just noting the clubhouse again, and note a minor reduction in the open space, going from 46.7% open space to 46.4%, and that relates to parking going into the Duke Power easement. It involves a minor reduction in open space. That parking was contemplated and identified on the original Winmore plans, and now they're basically bringing that to fruition. Vicinity map, this is the South Camellia site. This shows the property actually going straight down into Claremont, but it's this southwest corner of the Winmore site. I've flipped the slide at this point to show you kind of a north-south orientation. The two sites shown in yellow are the two affordable housing buildings. And just a couple of elements to show you again. Again, sidewalks are proposed all the way around the units connecting up to South Camellia. Parking area, again, I just noted the Duke power line runs north south in this location, and this parking area along the rear of the site is actually in the Duke power easement. It's also parking over here on the south of the site, and parking in this location as well. A few changes to note quickly. First, there's a courtyard proposed to replace what was originally. You can kind of see there's a driveway alley here connecting back to here. So they're proposing to get rid of the alley driveway in favor of this courtyard plaza area. Also, over here, there actually now exists another alley drive connection, and they're proposing to get rid of that one in favor of a new one at this location. And again, it just provides a nice clean separation between the townhomes to the north and this project to the south, allows some sunlight to go into the building in this location. And the CEP conditions for the arbors are basically repeated on the resolution for this project, with the exception of one stormwater item, because it was not applicable to this site. And that's all I have.
Questions, Joel?
I noticed in one of the conditions about the name.
Yes, ma'am.
And I guess my question is, why can't it just be the arbors at Winmore and the arbors too at Winmore? I mean, how... And the reason I say this, because if they all similarly have, I'm sorry, the same name, or something similar, and they are part of a larger, if I understand the application correctly, that these residents can use all the amenities of the recreation points because that's what's being used to determine that there's sufficient recreation points, then why have the differing names that really don't reflect a unity of the development itself?
Just to clarify, the Arbors was the original name, and I guess just to make it clear for my purposes to try and keep the project separate in my head, I kept the name Arbors on the West Windmore side, the first one I showed you tonight,
right,
and called the South Camellia site Griffith's Landing. But what happened was during the review process, the GIS administrator, she works with the Orange County Emergency Services,
right,
basically to ensure if there's a 911 call that they know where to go.
Right.
And they found that there are too many places called the Arbors or something similar already. So she made the request that they change the name from the Arbors to something else. The new choice was and is Griffith's Landing. The only question remaining and why you see that condition there is that she is still considering whether it's, I think, basically what you're getting at, whether it's appropriate to have both pieces called Griffith's Landing or require that they each have their own name, again, in the name of ensuring that an ambulance or a fire truck knows where to go precisely.
Yeah, but you have, like, Hogan Courts, Hogan something or other, Hogan Elks, Hogan Elks. And sort of for me, unity, I would request that you may not come up with a similar name, but maybe one that has a little more unity so one development doesn't feel totally different.
You mean I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but do you mean something like a Griffith's Landing for one and Griffith's Place for the other or something like
sure,
that?
Sure.
Is that what you're saying?
Some variation of Windmore something or other and Windmore something else or other.
Yeah, it'd be great to get Windmore
some,
in
some
there
continuity.
For the youth.
There's
maybe
some continuity. And okay. I just don't want there to be different treatment
right
of folk because it sounds so different.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jackie.
My question is about the affordable units. And determining that they're affordable units, is that based on, and I should know this and I don't, is that based on the cost of the unit or on the income of the renter? So, I mean, I know when we're talking affordable housing to buy that it's, you know, 80% of median or below, but you know, if affordable rental means, you know, it costs $250 a month, then it's going to fill with graduate students. So is there any way to make sure that it's families and...
Dean, could you come speak to that, please?
I should know this. I'm sorry, I don't... You know.
I'll defer to them because
okay.
Most of what we deal with are for sale. So this
right.
Is
and I know that the land trust usually... I mean, I'm really happy that we've got affordable rental coming in.
Right, and so are we. Thank you very much. Good question. The affordability of these units is dictated by the tax credits that we're using for the project. That is 60% of the area median income, which is $62,100 per. And we have to maintain that affordability, obviously, throughout the time
period.
So
I guess my question is, you know, around here, love them as much as I do, the students gobble up all the affordable housing. So is there any way to make sure that this is going to stay with families?
In fact, students aren't allowed to rent in tax credit units. If you're a full-time student, you cannot actually rent a tax credit.
You don't qualify.
You do not qualify.
And
thanks.
Y'all built the, what do you call it, over in Chapel Hill?
Dobbins Hill.
Oh,
that was a long time. I remember that.
Yeah.
But
we just
added
new units over Dobbins Hill. So.
Right. And right, new phase of Dobbins Hill. But I guess my point is, and I can tell you for sure, you know, it's reaching the target audience over
great
there at Dobbins
yeah
Hill.
It really has been.
Y'all did a beautiful job
thank
building
you
over there, by the
thank
way.
We appreciate that, and we're going to do the same here, obviously. But yeah, it can't be used by students.
Wonderful. Thank you. I really appreciate your work.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a question about the courtyard area. I mean, I don't know if Marty can answer it. What's the surface of the courtyard area, and what is it going to have any amenities, benches, you know, awnings, whatever it's?
I'll let Brandon.
Okay.
Because of the landscape plan, an image of grass and shrubs, there'll be sidewalks throughout.
Oh, wait, wrong side.
Yep.
I don't have the landscape plan for this particular one.
Yeah, the previous. Well, you can see the.
Oh, the one from the concept plan, you mean?
Yeah.
You can pull that
out. Well, listen, I mean, if you want to describe it.
Oh, it's a mixture of. I guess zoom in. Never mind, he's got the latest and greatest.
Where's my name?
You're trying to change your name. Which you can if you want, but.
Yeah, they said page down.
There you go.
I'm going to zoom in here. Actually, sir. There you go.
Oh, right.
Oh, that'd be nice.
How do I zoom in here?
With the purple.
PowerPoint.
Yeah. Yeah. The red buds are coming in.
There you go. Because these are the picnic area with grills, through the sidewalks, the shrubbery, the grass, etc.
Okay, that's great.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom.
That's too nice. Ask them a sort of an off-topic
question. No, it is only on time.
9:56, but go ahead.
That's just no. It's just one question. If they can answer, if they can't, that's all right. Do you expect, just in the economy, that you will see more of these tax credit projects or less?
I'll defer that to James.
Mr. Edwards.
Do you think, because of the economy, you'll see more or less tax credit?
I hope so.
Projects like this. I'm just curious.
It's been a difficult year. there's been less tax credit projects in this past year because of the boiling of the market.
Mm-hmm.
We've got less investors. In fact, we lost three different investors on this project, and thank goodness Bank of America stepped up and gave us a commitment, and the commitment's about to run out, so that's why it's always compared.
No problem.
Okay. All right. Is there anybody else here who would like to speak on either of these public hearings? Seeing none, is there a motion to close the public hearing?
Second. Close the public hearing. Do we have to do them separately for each one, or?
Yes, I think the decision.
But that, I think the motion for closing both public hearings.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's been moved and seconded that we close both public hearings. The second was from Randy. All those in favor of closing both public hearings, signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed. Matter passed unanimously. Okay, and then if we can consider one worksheet at a time.
Okay.
So is there a motion to find that
the offer's application is complete? So moved.
Second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded that it's complete. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously.
Move that it complies with all applicable requirements of the land use ordinance.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passed unanimously.
Move conditions number 1-7.
Okay. Does that address, by moving those, is that going to address the screening issues that were brought up? Or I guess what I'm saying is it seemed like they were asking for a degree of flexibility.
I'm not sure. Were you asking for
To be able to work?
Oh, regarding the front. I know what you're saying now.
Right.
That is not addressed in any particular way at this point.
Yeah, they were asking not to have a condition, saying they don't want a condition. They want to work with Marty.
I see.
Yeah, it was an advisory board comment subsequent to what the staff recommendation said.
Right.
You mean, so it would be EA. When you move, did you move the staff conditions or all of the conditions included?
You moved
with the staff conditions.
Oh, okay.
Staff conditions. Okay. And does that include something about the bike racks then or not?
I think they were going to work with staff.
I think that's the same condition.
Okay.
They have to work with staff.
I got you. Okay.
Well, how do we feel about that? About the screening?
How do you feel about it?
I would like to see some language that
addresses it, because I think it, I think we'd be remiss to allow it to go forward with people, knowing people are going to move in and be looking at someone else's driveway. I just think that that's not.
Well, you know, Randy, every time I open my door, I look right through your garage.
Not directly.
Not directly.
First thing I say. And I think that, you know, it was interesting because one of the photos that was shown to show the railing showed the, I guess they were like the japonicas around the air conditioning unit. That's all it would take. I don't see that. Maybe I'm missing something. I don't see it as any big deal, but
we're trying to,
you don't feel like
guess,
it needs
I guess
to be.
I guess my feeling is that having seen the work that they've done over in Chapel Hill, that I have a pretty high degree of confidence that they'll put together something that we can all be
they'll
pretty
work
proud
itself.
Of.
So. Okay.
All right.
Then I can live with that.
So are there any proposed changes? If not, it's been moved to have those seven conditions.
Seconded.
All those in favor?
Aye.
By saying aye. All those opposed? Matter passes unanimously.
Moved that the application be granted.
Second.
Been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The matter passes unanimously.
Moved the resolution approving a minor modification for Griffith's Landing.
Second.
Is there?
There's not a worksheet.
No worksheet.
There's no resolution of consistency or anything on that?
With the understanding that y'all will work on that name thing.
Right.
With the others, yes.
With the understanding that y'all have worked on the name.
That's okay. Naming of the section.
Mark, that's attachment D.
The okay. Development. Right. That section.
All right. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously.
Great.
I hesitate to ask whether there are any other matters.
Yeah, I have a quick something. I hope you all will indulge me in talking about, just because I want to kind of know where we stand going into the assembly.
It has nothing to do with anything, the assembly of government. I thought you'd like that.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Okay.
On the Rogers Road thing, where we're being asked to consider, I guess what you call compensation for the years of proximity of the landfill, and there are kind of three issues. One is, what's the compensation and sewer, perhaps something else? The second would be what the implementation would be, and the third would be how it gets paid for. And so the question I have for you all is, to my thinking, everyone in the county over the life of the landfill benefited equally from the landfill and therefore is equally contributory to whatever the harm is, if we think of it that way, to the Rogers Road neighborhood. And so therefore the cost should be divided among county residents, and that the way to do that is through the county property tax. And that if it's suggested that, say, one or more of the municipalities ought to pay an additional share, it would need to be demonstrated that the citizens of the municipality in some way benefited more than citizens elsewhere from the landfill and therefore contributed more to the harm. So that's really my question. I want to raise that with you all before going to the meeting to kind of see where we think about that as a board. And really the question is, you know, do Carborough citizens have a special, an extra burden for this, say, more so than, the people in our ETJ, for example?
Or should they have to pay it twice?
I don't disagree with your logic at all, Dan. I'll just point out that, for example, when you talk about the sewer lines that would need to be extended up into that area, that those sewer lines, whenever they eventually get built, will benefit the owners of some undeveloped or underdeveloped properties that are in Chapel Hill's annexation area, and, you know, will lead to the growth of tax base in Chapel Hill, and there may be, you know, that may be a consideration in the question of who ought to pay for it. It doesn't lead to any growth particular, not no notable
okay.
growth
yeah,
in the tax
point.
Base
so
of the town of Carrboro.
There could be benefits to the sewer line beyond just the
right.
compensation.
The compensation aspect
land.
Of it. But most of the, you know, I mean, there's, I think, about 5 acres of underdeveloped land out there on the Carrboro side of Rogers Road, whereas there's, you know, 50 or 100 acres on the Chapel Hill side.
Joel, you were on that task force. Was there any discussion of this kind of stuff, or do you have any sense of that question?
I have 2 senses of the question.
Okay.
One, I think the residents want to find a way that sewer could happen. Part of the problem with the extension of sewer and water is the cost of getting from the Owassa-owned part to somebody's house.
And it's also that some of the houses are so old that in order for them to be able to take the water pressure,
right,
that the interior pipes can't handle the water pressure. Mm. And so I imagine going out would have the same problem as going in. And so there's some, I remember years and years and years ago when we first started looking at that, that was a real problem, and it just skyrockets the cost.
Now, I think that, you know, that's one issue. I think the other issue is certainly how does it get paid for, and whether or not the towns and the county could use whatever political will they can to seek maybe monies from the federal government in a larger CDBG grant or something like that. And I don't think there really has been enough and sufficient discussion about that.
Or, and I'll throw this out late at night, we all own some land in common out there.
Yeah, but, you know, we have argued about what we do with it, and people want to treat it like open space when I think,
well, I think selling
it. No, we already have an agreement about what we're doing on
yeah.
Green Tract.
Yeah, which, you know, it's, you almost want to say, well, that'd be too wild
okay.
to say because nobody would agree with
if
me.
If you only almost want to say it, then don't say it.
Mark, I just want to say before we officially close, I will not be at the meeting on Thursday, and I want to just say that ahead of time so folks know that I'm not there.
Yeah,
and
I bet you're
you,
so disappointed.
You all need to.
Yeah.
I'll send you my thoughts and please share them and have fun without me.
Don't we have the Carolina North?
No, that's on the 31st. It's next week.
Yeah, do that.
I have a meeting at work on Thursday.
I'm sorry, I don't have a meeting.
No,
meeting
sorry. I have a meeting at work on Thursday from 5 to 6, and then I have to come home.